Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. As promised, Jimmy Agin here with us this hour. Jimmy's senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, the author of lots and lots of things, including The Bible is a Catholic Book, and the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Hello again, Jimmy Agin.
Hello, Cy Kellett. How you doing?
I'm doing really well for a Tuesday. I don't know why a Tuesday would be bad. I don't know why I said it that way, but I'm doing pretty well. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay, too.
I will try not to ask you what's going to drop tomorrow on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, but Friday something will drop. What do we got coming up on Friday?
Friday is the 5th anniversary of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, and so we're going to have an episode where the listeners have sent in their mysterious experiences, and so we're going to be hearing all about mysterious things that have happened to them, and I'm going to offer some thoughts on them.
All right, mysterious.fm is where you can check it out, mysterious.fm, or just put in your machine, Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. 5-year anniversary. So I know I have congratulated you before, but let me congratulate you again on 5 years of really exciting podcasts.
Thank you.
Looking forward to 5 more at least. At least.
Yeah, at least.
Expect a minimum of 5 more out of you. The number is 888-318-7884. Oh, you know what? I'm giving you the number, but all the lines are full. So we should probably just take some calls and then you can call.
Let's empty some out.
Michael in Missouri is watching on YouTube. Hi, Michael. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Oh, hello.
Hi.
Yes, I am a recently converted Catholic, and I've noticed some issues in the church that I've kind of inherited between, like, grad trads and, like, everybody else.
Okay. How can I help?
Well, people have been telling me that since I received communion in the hand, that I'm an agent of Satan. And it's sacrilege.
Wow.
So how do I go about this exactly?
Well, anyone who's been telling you that is mistaken. They're just wrong. They've fallen prey to a mind virus, and they have accepted inaccurate information and are assuming they're sincere in what they're telling you. They are sincerely mistaken. There's nothing sinful about receiving communion in the hand. And when people tell you something, you know, that doesn't create an obligation to believe it. So you can always say, well, okay, so how would you justify that if you want to engage them in dialogue? And they could have arguments they might come back with. They might say things like, well, a priest's hands are blessed. But yeah, but that doesn't mean it's wrong. And I mean, your tongue isn't blessed, is it, in any way beyond just, you know, being a baptized, confirmed Christian. So if you can receive Jesus onto your not specially blessed tongue, you could hold Jesus in your not specially blessed hand. So the argument that priests have a special blessing just doesn't make any sense. Also, even before the reform of the liturgy, there were people besides priests who could distribute communion, and they did not have a special priestly blessing on their hands. For example, deacons and acolytes could distribute communion as well. And so there's just nothing to this claim. The practice of communion in the hand has been around for a very long time. And we find it in the writings of the church fathers. For example, if you read various church fathers, they'll talk about how they received communion in the hand in their own day. And they'd say things like, so you put one hand, you put your left hand up, and then you put your right hand on top of your left hand to make a throne for Jesus. And that's how you receive communion in the hand, according to the custom that was in use in some places in the Christian world in the age of the church fathers. So this is not some new, horrendous, awful invention of today. It's something that's actually has a very long history in the Catholic Church. And if one has respect for the church fathers and the teaching authority of the church today, which has approved this practice, then one shouldn't be stressed over this. It's perfectly legitimate to receive communion in the hand. And if someone is telling you that you're an agent of Satan, I would say, well, this person is probably not the right person to hang out with right now, especially if one is a new Catholic and you may not feel like you want to really engage with a person like that. I'd say don't engage with them.
Okay. Understood.
All right, Michael.
Well, awesome.
All right. Thank you, Michael. Thanks for the call. Maybe we'll talk again as more questions come up. I'm going to go to another Michael in Buffalo, New York, watching on YouTube. Michael, thank you for waiting. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hello, Jimmy. Thank you for everything you're doing to bring people to the Catholic faith, and I absolutely love your Mysteries channel.
Oh, thank you.
So I'm a new RCIA catechist, and I often have difficulty defending the faith with different worldviews, different faiths, and I was wondering what you would recommend to start really digging into apologetics, because I just find so many different worldviews. There's so many different angles, whether you're having a conversation with an atheist, an agnostic, a Protestant, a Muslim, somebody who practices Hinduism, you know, somebody who's just a lukewarm Catholic. And I just wanted to know from the master, where do you think I should start?
Well, I would make three suggestions. The first one is Catholic.com. We've got thousands of resources available for you for free on Catholic.com. So if you're talking to a person coming from a particular point of view, you can go to Catholic.com, and in the search feature, you can type in whatever point of view they're coming from. And that'll give you basic information about it. If they have a specific objection or a specific question, you could also type in their objection or their question. And odds are you're going to find something about it right there for you for free on Catholic.com. I'd also suggest, so this is my second suggestion, I'd suggest that you get a background in, at least in a basic way, how to defend the Christian faith and the Catholic understanding of the Christian faith. And the good news on that is we have this thing called the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics. It's an online service where you can get courses and work your way through the course at your own pace. The courses are made out of short video segments, so it's not a lot of time commitment. You just watch the video segments when it's convenient for you. And I would suggest starting with the Introduction to Apologetics or Beginning Apologetics course. It's one that I taught, and it's, often one of the first ones that people take. So I'd suggest going to schoolofapologetics.com and getting the beginning apologetics course and working your way through that. And we also have more advanced apologetics courses there as well, and we're adding new ones all the time. The third thing I would suggest is getting a copy of my book, A Daily Defense, where I cover more than 300 different objections to faith and to the Christian faith and to the Catholic understanding of the Christian faith. And since we're here on the radio and you're in the United States, we can actually send you one of those. So if you can hang on the phone line, we'll send you a free copy of A Daily Defense, and that'll get you started.
Thank you so much.
Well, no problem.
Thank you, Michael, for the call and for the work that you are endeavoring now to help people come into the Catholic Church. So hang on. We'll get the information, and we'll send you out that book. Man, lines continue full. They don't even say open for a second, so off we go now to Nebraska. Dominic's in Nebraska watching on YouTube. Glad to have you here, Dominic. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, Jimmy. Thanks. I also have the Daily Defense,
Defense
book, and I am loving it.
Awesome.
Yes, the Daily Defense book. Awesome. Thank you. And for my question, I wanted to ask, is it morally acceptable to kill a baby in the womb if that baby would end up killing the mother and end up killing the child?
So the standard approach to this question is no, you can't directly kill the baby. You can do other things that may result in the baby's death, but they aren't directly attacking the baby itself. One of the classic examples here is the case of a tubal pregnancy, where instead of implanting in the womb, the baby regrettably implants in one of the mother's fallopian tubes and starts growing there. And if nothing is done, then the baby will eventually get to a size where it's going to cause an internal hemorrhage that could kill the mother if she suddenly hemorrhages inside and, is internally bleeding. That could severely damage her and possibly even kill her, and also that hemorrhage is going to kill the baby. So the standard solution for that kind of situation is not to directly attack the baby, but to remove the problematic section of the fallopian tube, because the fallopian tube is now damaged by the baby implanting, and removing something that's damaged is not a problem at all, morally speaking. So you can remove the damaged section of the fallopian tube, and it contains the baby, and you can foresee that, well, outside of the mother, since we don't yet have artificial wombs, the baby is not going to survive for very long. And so you foresee the baby is going to die. And that was going to happen anyway. Even if you left the baby in, the baby was going to die. But what you're not doing in this case is attacking the baby. You're disconnecting the diseased fallopian tube that happens to contain the baby, and you foresee that the baby will die, but you are not attacking the baby. It's not like you take a knife and stab the baby in the heart. That would be a direct attack on the baby. And this procedure is often justified under what's known as the principle of double effect. The principle of double effect holds that in some cases, it is legitimate to undertake an action that it has a foreseen negative effect, provided that certain conditions are met. One of the conditions is the negative effect. So in this case, the negative effect is the child's going to die. But one of the conditions is the negative effect is not your goal. So your goal is not to kill the child. You're not taking a scalpel and stabbing the baby in the heart. So it's not your goal. If you could take the baby out and have the baby survive, you would do that. The second condition is that the negative effect is not a means to your goal. Now, your goal in this case is saving the life of the mother. The death of the baby is not a means to that. If you could take the baby out and save the baby's life some other way, then you would do that. And so this is not, you're not killing the baby in order to save the mother, because you're not attacking the baby. What you're doing is removing a diseased body organ that happens to have the baby in it. So you're just disconnecting, but you're not attacking the baby. The third condition is that there must be a good effect that is at least as good as the negative effect is bad. And saving the mother's life is that effect. The life of one person, if both of them are going to die, if you do nothing, or at least be in danger of death, and if only one of them is going to die if you do this procedure, then you're saving a life. You know, specifically the mother's life in this case, and her life and the baby's life are equal because they're both human beings. And as a result, the good effect of saving the mother's life does counterbalance the negative effect of the baby's foreseen death. So in this case, the death of the baby is a foreseen side effect of an otherwise reasonable procedure. And it's not something you're deliberately bringing about. In fact, in the future, we may have artificial wombs that you can just transplant the baby into the artificial womb and it'll be fine. Just like today, if you have to deliver a baby early, you can put it in an incubator. Incubators are essentially generation one artificial wombs. They're designed to help babies who are not yet ready to experience the world without the environment of a womb. And so an incubator helps create an environment that is a lot like the womb in terms of, you know, temperature and things like that. So in the future, we may have even better wombs, artificial wombs that you could use to save the baby's life. And this would presumably be totally fine. At least it would in my view.
Dominic, I want to leave it there because it's time for our first break this hour. Thank you for the call and the question. There's now two lines open, 888-318-7884. Back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Your questions, Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
carry the faith wherever you go. Watch the EWTN series, specials, events, and news streaming live from anywhere in the world. Streaming is available on the EWTN app for Apple, Android, and Amazon devices. Download the EWTN app at EWTNapps.com today.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. How about this lineup for the Catholic Answers Apologetics Conference? Professor Scott Hahn, Sister Regina Marie Gorman, Dale Alquist, Dr. Francis Beckwith, Dr. Logan Gage, Father Paul Check, Jimmy Akin, Tim Staples, Carlo Broussard, Trent Horn, and many more, including we'll do the radio program from there. If you'd like to come, we're going to be talking about belief in God. I believe in God is the theme. And you can find out all about it at CatholicAnswersConference.com. It's always, well, at least in recent years, it's always been the last full weekend of September. It is again this year. Check it out. And if you can make it, we'd love it. We'd love it if you were there. CatholicAnswersConference.com. It's open forum this hour. Jimmy Akin is our guest. And we're going to Cincinnati to talk to Max, who's watching on YouTube. Max, are you there with us?
Yeah.
Hello, Max. How old are you?
Six.
You're six. Well, thank you very much for calling. Go ahead with your question for Mr. Akin.
Why can't you receive communion until second grade?
Well, in the part of the Catholic Church that you and I belong to, which is called the Latin Church or the Roman Church, a decision was made some time ago that children ordinarily shouldn't begin receiving communion until about the age of reason, which is often reckoned to be about 7 years old. And so since 7 years old is when people are in the second grade, it's very common in many places for children to receive the Holy Communion when they're that old. But it's not an absolute requirement that they wait until that time. In some other parts of the Catholic Church, they actually give communion to babies. But a decision was made in the Roman Church that you and I are part of to give communion at the age of reason. And so that's when it's generally done. Now, I mentioned that the age of reason is reckoned or estimated to normally occur at around age 7. But there are exceptions. Some children reach the age of reason sooner, some reach it later. And so it's not an absolute requirement that you wait until second grade. There were situations, for example, where Pope Pius XII, who was Pope some time ago, would give Holy Communion to children who were 5 years old. So it really depends on the individual child, but most children are thought to have the age of reason when they're about 7 years old, and that corresponds to second grade. And so that's a common practice here in the United States for when to begin giving children Holy Communion.
Does that all make sense to you, Max?
Oh, yeah.
All right, very good. Well, you're almost there. You're almost 7 yourself. So
yeah,
if you'd like, and if there's an adult there with you that you can put on the phone with us, we'd like to send you a book called "The Truth Is Out There." It's a what do they call those? Not a comic book, a graphic novel. Yeah, a graphic novel. If you'd like that, then ask whoever the adult is to take the phone and Edgar will get the information where we can send you that book. Open forum this hour. Jimmy Akin, our guest. Nancy in Omaha, Nebraska, next, listening on Spirit Catholic Radio. Hi, Nancy. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi. So my question is, can I receive communion, like, even though I don't really believe in the true presence of the Eucharist yet? I've heard differing, like, things. Like, I ask one person, and they're like, yeah, it'll help you believe. I ask one person, and they're like, no, that's, like, really disrespectful. What should I do?
So, have you been baptized or received into the Catholic Church?
Yeah, I'm confirmed.
Okay, good. Just wanted to check. Well, if you presently have doubts about the reality of the real presence, as long as you can say to yourself, I accept that Jesus is here, even if you don't feel confident that he's here, as long as you can accept it as an act of the will and say, I accept this teaching. Jesus said that this is his body and blood, and I accept what Jesus said, and that he really meant it, that this really is his body and blood. If you can accept it, even if you don't feel confident about it, then you could receive, you know, assuming you've, you know, been to confession if you need to go to confession, and assuming you've fasted mm-hmm. for an hour, all the usual conditions. If you can say to yourself, I accept it, I accept that he's really here, then you could receive communion. If you don't feel that you can accept that, then you should not receive. This is based on something that St. Paul says in 1 Corinthians. In 1 Corinthians, St. Paul says that if we eat or drink the Eucharist without recognizing it as the body and blood of Christ, then we become guilty of the body and blood of Christ, and we may experience negative consequences as a result. So you don't, he says, you can eat and drink judgment to yourself if you receive it without accepting what it really is. So you don't have to feel confidence, but you do have to accept what Jesus said. You may even feel uncomfortable, but as long as you can say, I accept that Jesus was telling the truth and this really is him, then you can receive. But if you can't make that affirmation of faith, which is what you're doing when you go up for communion and they hold up the host and they say the body of Christ and you say amen, you're agreeing that's mm-hmm. really Jesus. And you would be lying if you didn't believe that it's really Jesus. So mm-hmm. So as long as you can accept that it's really Jesus, you can receive. But if you don't feel in a position to truthfully say, yeah, that's Jesus, I accept that, then you should refrain from receiving.
Okay, that's, now this is even more complicated. Oh, no. Like you said that, like, even though I'm not, like, confident, I can still...
Mm-hmm.
This is even more complicated. Like, okay,
Yeah, it's not about your emotions. Confidence is an emotion, and faith is not about your emotions. Our emotions go all over the place in our lives. Sometimes we feel we have great confidence. Sometimes we don't feel we have great confidence. Sometimes we feel angry. Sometimes we feel happy. Don't focus on your emotions. If, as an act of the will, you can say, yeah, I accept this, then you have faith that this is Jesus. And if you have faith that this is Jesus, then you can receive.
Okay.
Okay.
And we have a lot of resources, by the way, at Catholic.com that are online for free that talk about the Eucharist and talk about the real presence. You might want to check those. And, you know, just go to Catholic.com and put real presence into, or communion or Eucharist or whatever you want. And a lot of stuff will pop up for you that you can review that you know, may help you out.
If you'd like it, you know what, we have a new book that I haven't really been sending out to people, and I'd like to send it to somebody. So if you'd like a copy of a new book we have called The Eucharist Really Is Jesus. Don't take it if you don't want it, Nancy, but if you want it, just hang on, and we'll get an address, and we'll send it out to you. Thank you very, very much for the call. Maybe this is one where follow-up questions will occur to you, and you are always welcome back here. Let's go to Lewis in Missouri, watching on YouTube. Lewis, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
No? Yes.
Oh, hi, Lewis.
Hello. I'd like to just say thank you for everything you guys do. I returned to the church after being gone for 10 years because of you guys.
Oh, praise God.
And my wife will be going through RCIA this fall because of you. So thank you.
Oh, well, thank you for sharing it with us, Lewis. That's really great news. It's beautiful. Thank you very much.
Okay, my question is, so... In Corinthians, St. Paul states that you have to be worthy to accept communion. Mm-hmm. He states that, you know, you have to be if you accept it unworthily, then it can be bad for you.
to paraphrase. But yet in Mass, we say, I'm not worthy to receive you. So is there a bit of a contradiction, or can you explain
there are differences. There are different senses in which something is done worthily. Now, in 1 Corinthians, St. Paul says you need to receive in a worthy manner. And a worthy manner is one where you're, as a baptized Christian, you recognize this is Jesus, you're not clinging to grave sin, and so forth. But there's more to say, and I'll say it on the other side of the break.
Hang on, Lewis. We will take that break and be right back. Lots of folks on the line. Jimmy Akin here as our guest, and that means lots more open forum to come on Catholic Answers Live. This year, the Catholic Answers Conference turns its attention to the question of God in an age of unbelief. Join us September 21st through 24th in San Diego for I Believe in God, featuring very special guest Scott Hahn and an all-star lineup of speakers. Spend four fun days with your favorite Catholic Answers apologists. Seats are still available, but going fast. Use promo code EARLY to save $50 and register today at CatholicAnswersConference.com.
Our Lord needs articulate defenders of the truth to spread the joy of the Catholic faith. Catholic Answers Monthly Giving Club, Society 315, helps you fulfill the call in 1 Peter 3:15 to always be prepared to make a defense for the hope that is in you. For as little as $10 a month, you'll help Catholics grow in faith, bring lapsed Catholics home, and lead non-Catholics to the truth. Go to casociety315.com and join today.
Want to know more about the origins of the Catholic Church? Joe Heschmeyer explores the beginnings of Christianity. In the early church was the Catholic Church. Joe digs deep into the words and actions of those who lived right after the apostles to refute anti-Catholic claims of how the faith was lived back then. Order your copy of The Early Church Was the Catholic Church today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
As Catholic apologetics have gotten stronger, Protestant responses have gotten stronger as well. And now they have their own answers to rebut the standard Catholic proofs. Don't fret, we've got you covered. In his new book, Meeting the Protestant Response, apologist Carlo Broussard gives well-reasoned biblical answers to Protestant comebacks. Order your copy of Meeting the Protestant Response today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Dr. David Anders here. Where is purgatory in the Bible? Why confess my sins to a priest?
Find out more tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern on Call to Communion.
Now, back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin's here, and it's open forum. Your call's welcome, 888-318-7884. We're going back to answer Lewis's question. But first, I got to say congratulations to another longtime member of the EWTN radio family, St. Michael Radio. In Great Falls, Montana, they're celebrating their 17th year in the EWTN family. Congratulations to Tony Roush and his team at KSMR from all of us here at Catholic Answers and the whole EWTN crew. Lewis was asking about, Lord, I am not worthy. We say that before receiving the Eucharist, but St. Paul says don't receive the Eucharist unworthily, and you were in the midst of an answer, yeah. Jimmy.
So to receive unworthily would be to receive without discerning that this is the body and blood of Christ, and to receive where you're clinging to, you know, mortal sin and things like that. So we don't want to receive like that. But is, even though worthily is, you know, an adverb that applies to the manner of receiving, we can kind of translate a person who is receiving worthily into an adjective that modifies the person and say this person is worthy because they're, and what we mean by that is they're receiving in a manner that is worthy. So they're receiving worthily. But we do have this line about, Lord, I'm not worthy. Well, okay. So if you have an apparent, you know, juxtaposition of terms like this, where there seemed to be intention in them, what you want to do is say, okay, they probably mean two different things. So we've talked about what receiving worthily means. What would it mean to say, I'm worthy of something? Well, commonly what it means is I deserve it.
Yeah.
I'm worthy of this. I deserve this. You know, Cy Kellett might say, I'm worthy of chocolate ice cream after dinner. I deserve chocolate ice cream after dinner. It is not a gift if someone gives me chocolate ice cream after dinner. But it might be, and it might be true that Cy is worthy of chocolate ice cream. It's his just desserts, you might even say. And consequently, it's not a gift if someone provides him with chocolate ice cream. He may have even paid for it. So that's a common sense of the word worthy. But to the extent we even use the word worthy these days, it used to be much more common than it is now. But Cy Kellett, even if you're worthy of chocolate ice cream for dinner, are you worthy of receiving your Lord Jesus Christ, the Almighty Son of God and infinitely holy Creator, in an intimate act like Holy Communion?
I am not.
Do you deserve that, or is that a gift?
That is a pure gift.
Yeah, so that's the key to reconciling these two different statements. We don't deserve Jesus in Holy Communion in the sense that he owes it to us, that, you know, it's not a gift that he's giving us. And so what that first statement does is it recognizes the gift nature of Holy Communion. And that's what we mean when we say, I'm not worthy that you should enter under my roof, which is a line from, you know, the Gospels. And it's a line in the Gospels, by the way, that Jesus responded positively to. It's from the Roman centurion who had the sick servant. And when Jesus says, okay, I'll come heal him, the centurion says, oh, no, I'm not worthy that you should enter under my roof. Just say the word and my servant will be healed. And Jesus is impressed by his faith. So Jesus responds positively to that line. But what that line in Mass is doing is recognizing that, you know, we are and have been sinful creatures who are finite and who are not deserving of receiving the infinite, all-holy Son of God in an intimate act like Holy Communion. This is a gift that's being given to us. But we want to make sure that we receive the gift in an appropriate way. And that's what St. Paul is talking about when he says you need to receive the body and blood of our Lord worthily, because if you don't, then you're receiving it inappropriately, and we don't want to receive gifts in an inappropriate way. That'll offend the giver, and we don't want to offend the giver of this gift.
Okay, Lewis?
That makes a lot of sense. So basically, if, you know, we are worthy, but we're unworthy in the sense that we're fallen creatures.
You're breaking up. I'm sorry, Lewis. A lot of that broke up, but it sounded like you were on the track. But I couldn't tell because I was getting about every second sentence, maybe third. But I'm going to say thanks, Lewis, and keep moving because lots of folks remain on the lines for Jimmy. Michael's in Omaha, Nebraska, listening on Spirit Catholic Radio. Michael, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, thank you. So I had heard yesterday or the day before whoever was speaking on Catholic Answers said that that a soul in heaven can't choose something that's not good. And I get that they wouldn't choose something that's not good, but it sounded like, and he repeated it a few times, I don't remember the word he used, but it sounded like they didn't have free will. And so the question was, do souls in heaven still have free will?
Okay, I don't know who was speaking, and I didn't hear them say whatever they said in this discussion, so I can't really comment on that. But what I can do is tell you what I think. Now, the Church does not have a teaching in this area, certainly never one that I've encountered. So this is theology. This is a matter of theology. It's a matter of speculation and opinion. Well, God gave us free will, and he gave it to us to use, especially in this life. But I don't see any reason why we would need to lose it when we're in heaven. Because we have a range of possible choices. Now, in this life, we are able to either choose good things or bad things. We can choose between good and evil. But even if we're perfected in heaven so that we can't or won't choose evil, and there's a distinction there, but it's a kind of tricky distinction, but whether it's can't choose evil or won't choose evil, we can still choose among different good things. And so I don't see any reason to say we lose free will in heaven. We may have a different kind of free will where we have different choices we're able to choose between, you know, namely, we can only choose between the good ones. But there are choices I can't make right now in this life. I can't choose to fly under my own power because I don't have wings and I don't have the kind of body structure and skeleton like a bird does that would enable me to fly. So right now there are certain choices that are not within my ability to make, but that doesn't mean I lack free will over the range of choices that I can make. And in the same way, if in the future I'm elevated into a glorified state, it may, you know, I may level up and have new choices that suddenly unlock for me, but they'll all be good. And so just because I can't make certain choices now doesn't mean I lack free will. And in the same way, once we're in heaven, even if we can't choose evil as opposed to just won't choose evil, then I'll still have free will. It's just going to be over a range of choices that are all good, and I can pick among the different good choices. Now, you do draw a distinction between can't and won't in terms of choosing evil. And I would say that this distinction is a very subtle one. I don't want to say that it's a distinction without a difference. I think there likely is a difference there, but I am unable to articulate precisely what the difference is. Because if I try to say why the person won't choose evil ever in heaven, then it ends up looking like they really can't choose evil. So I have a hard time articulating what this difference would mean in concrete terms, but I don't think that it's necessary to do that in order to address this subject, because whether it's can't choose evil or won't choose evil, that doesn't say anything about not being able to choose among a whole bunch of different goods. And if I can choose among a whole bunch of different goods, then I still have free will. It's just configured differently than free will is in this life.
Michael, thanks very much for the question. As I've been saying, lots of folks on the line, so I'm going to keep moving. I'm going to go to Pennsylvania. David in Pennsylvania, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hello, Jimmy. I'm sorry. So my question today is, how do I interact with schismatic Catholics, including like the ultra traditionalists, and especially in the context of finding a future spouse, and just interactions with younger Catholics in general, as there seems to be a trend towards radical traditionalism and such these days?
Okay, there's a big difference between people who are traditionalists and people who are schismatic. There's also something of a kind of middle zone between people who are traditionalist but perfectly sound in their approach to Catholicism and people who are so unsound they've left the church. There's a kind of blurry middle ground, and that some people will call them radical traditionalists, whether you want to, many of them object to that term. But there is a kind of middle zone that is so disaffected and so opposed to things that they perceive as problems in the church today that their affiliation with the church is at least shaky. Well, so you asked specifically about how to interact with people in this area in terms of finding a spouse. I would say if they're in the middle zone, where their attachment to the church is shaky, or if they're in the zone where they've actually left the church, seek no spouse here. Because you're going to want to have, as a Catholic, you're going to want to have a spouse who is firm in their faith and loyal to the church, and that's the ideal. And it's only going to be a nightmare for you if you get into a situation where you're courting someone or even married to someone whose attachment to the church is shaky or non-existent. They're going to be angry. They're going to be constantly critical. It's going to be a nightmare for you. Now, if you find someone who's a Catholic and prefers, you know, traditional mass and so forth, and you're fine with that too, then yeah, you could marry that person. But if they are in this middle zone where they have a shaky attachment to the church, or if they are actually schismatic, have no spouse here. Do not pursue it. Do not waste your time in that area, because it will only end in pain. So that's what I'd have to say about finding a spouse. If they're just someone who likes, you know, Latin Mass and prefers traditional devotions and, you know, likes reading St. Thomas Aquinas or whatever, fine. But if it goes beyond that, I would say don't seek a spouse there. In terms of other interactions with them, I would say, well, why do you want to interact with someone who is schismatic? You can do so if you choose, you know, perhaps as a spiritual work of mercy. You may say, okay, there are people who've fallen for this viewpoint, and schism is a serious objective sin, whether they're personally culpable for it or not. And they might mislead other people, so they're causing scandal in the proper theological sense of leading other people into sin, namely the sin of schism. So you might say, well, I, as a spiritual work of mercy here, I'm going to interact with them to try to help them and at least answer their claims so that other people won't be led into sin. And that can be a worthy thing to do, but you need proper background for that. If you're going to do that, and that means you need to do some studying of this area, and we've got resources available at Catholic.com that can help you do that study.
Thank you, David. Time to take a break. We'll take a break and be right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
In Morse code, the sequence SOS is a distress call. It's been said that it stands for Save Our Souls. Well, right now our world is in big trouble, and we're putting out an SOS call for help. Will you answer that call? St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, has hundreds of teams who share the good news with souls who don't know Jesus. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to get involved.
EWTN, teaching the truth.
Thank you so much for all that you do, and your mother Angelica and her words. I'll never forget the first shows on television when I found her, and that led me to the radio station.
I'm an 8-year homeschooling mom. I'm a veteran of doing this for a long time. What encouraged me was this beautiful nun named Mother Angelica, and one day she said, well, if you don't like the school, why don't you just pull them out and homeschool them?
Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. Lots of callers on. Jimmy Akin here to answer questions, so back we go to the phones. Jake's in New Jersey watching on YouTube. Thanks for the call, Jake. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, Jimmy. So I'm a new RCIA candidate, and mm-hmm. I've asked multiple people to explain the Holy Trinity to me, and I still cannot wrap my hand around it.
Okay.
So are you able to give me a better explanation?
Well, I'll sure try. The doctrine of the Trinity is based on statements that are made by, among others, Jesus in the New Testament. And he's revealing something to us that is on the edge of our ability to understand. Because our minds, here in this world, we never see beings that are more than one person. But that's what the doctrine of the Trinity is. God is one being who is three persons. So he's tripersonal. And we don't see things like that here in the world. So our brains, which are you know, how we navigate this world. They're configured to help us understand and navigate things that we see in this world, you know, like rocks and rivers and birds and clouds and stuff like that. But we don't see tripersonal beings down here. So this is on the edge of our ability to understand in this life. Now, in the next life, our minds will be configured to the next world. So we'll have a better understanding, presumably, of the Trinity then. But right now, it's kind of on the edge. So what can we do here? Well, one of the things that we can do is realize there is no logical contradiction here, because that's usually people's biggest stumbling block when it comes to the Trinity. It's like, how can God be one in three? That sounds like if he's one, he shouldn't be three. If he's three, he shouldn't be one. You know, it sounds like a contradiction. So what we can do is recognize that, okay, this isn't a contradiction. It's kind of like, and you know, this may or may not, this particular example may or may not help you, but it's kind of like a hypercube. A hypercube is a four-dimensional cube. Now, we're used to seeing lines and squares and 3D cubes. We can see all those in our world around us, but we can't take it to an extra dimension. We can't visualize a four-dimensional cube, because our brains are configured to work in three spatial dimensions, not four. But despite the fact that we can't visualize a four-dimensional cube, we can work out the mathematics of them. And mathematicians have done that, and we can recognize there's nothing contradictory about the idea of a four-dimensional cube. We just can't visualize it because our imagination doesn't work that way. And something similar is true of the ability to envision a tripersonal God. We can't really fully do that, but we can realize there's no contradiction here. And once we realize there's no contradiction, and Jesus tells us that God is tripersonal, well, then if we're going to listen to Jesus, we need to say, okay, well, I can't visualize a tripersonal God, but I'm going to accept it because Jesus is a reliable source of information. He's one of the persons of the Trinity. He's qualified to tell me about God's internal life, and he tells me this, so I'm going to accept it. Just like if I'm thinking about hypercubes, you know, well, I could say I might not be a mathematician, but okay, the mathematicians tell me this is true about hypercubes, so I'll accept it even if I can't visualize it for myself. So let's look at the question of, does the Trinity involve a logical contradiction? Now, the definition of the Trinity is that God is one being who is three persons. You'll notice that the oneness and the threeness go in different categories. The oneness pertains to God's being, but the threeness pertains to the number of persons. So what's a being? Well, to use a bit of Black American English, it's anything that bees. That's why we call it a being. It's, you know, the verb to be indicates existence, and so a being is anything that exists. So Jake, you're a being, I'm a being, Sai's a being, the microphone in front of me is a being, the computer monitor or phone in front of you that you're watching YouTube on, that's a being. Everything that exists is a being. But are all beings persons? Well, no. Jake, you and me and Sai are all persons. So we are each one being, and each of these beings, you, me, and Sai, is one person. But not everything that's a being is a person. The microphone that's in front of me is a being. It exists. I really have a mic here, but it's not a person. And the computer or the screen, I'll say, where you're watching YouTube, whether it's on a computer or a phone or a tablet, the screen that you're watching YouTube on is a being. It really exists, but it's also not a person. And so what we see is that some beings, like microphones and screens, are zero persons. And some beings, like you, me, and Sai, are one person. So if you have some beings that are less than one person, like the microphone or the screen, and some beings like you, me, and Sai that are exactly one person, then there's no logical reason why there couldn't be a being that's more than one person. And that's what Jesus tells us God is. So the key to understanding the Trinity is recognizing that there's a difference between a being and a person. You and your screen are both beings, but not your screen is not a person and you are. So just like your screen is zero persons and you're one person, God is just a being who's more than one person, and there's no logical contradiction there. It may be hard for us to visualize that because our imaginations aren't set up to visualize that in this life, but we can see that there's no contradiction here, and Jesus gives us the assurance that this is true. If you'd like to review that, I actually talk about that in my book, A Daily Defense, and that also could be helpful for you in RCIA. So, Sai, let's see if we can send Jake a copy of A Daily Defense.
All right, Jake, if you'll hang on the line and give us an address, we'll send you a copy of Jimmy's book, A Daily Defense. And I'm going to just keep moving to try to get everybody that I can on with Jimmy. Ryan's in Illinois watching on Twitch. Ryan, if you can be quick with your question, we'll do our very best to get you an answer.
No problem. Hello, how are you guys doing? I have a question regarding whether or not Jewish people, I'm saying Jewish because I came across documents on it between an interfaith dialogue.
Okay, Ryan, I'm gonna need you to ask the question.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead with your question. We need you to be quick.
Golden. All right, cool. Can Jewish people be saved without a belief in Christ?
As long as they are innocently unaware of the truth of the Christian faith, then yes. God doesn't hold people accountable for things they're innocently unaware of. Just like, you know, so a Jewish person who lived before the time of Christ would not know that Jesus was going to be the Messiah. They were innocently unaware of the fact that Jesus is the Messiah, but that didn't stop them from being saved through Jesus Christ before the time of Jesus Christ. In the same way, if a Jewish person today, they may have heard someone say that Jesus is the Christ, but just because you hear someone say something, that doesn't require you to believe it. And so if a Jewish person today is innocently unaware of the fact that Jesus really is the Christ, but they otherwise live up to the light that and grace that God has given them, then they will be saved. They'll be saved through Jesus Christ. They won't know that in this life, but as long as they live up to whatever degree of light and grace God has given them, then they can be saved. And that's true not only of Jewish people, but of any religious position.
Okay. Thank you very much, Jimmy. I appreciate it.
No problem.
All right. Thank you very much. And that did go pretty quickly. And let's see if we can get another question in. We have to be very, very quick if we're going to. Roy in Pennsylvania listening to EWTN on Channel 130, Sirius XM Satellite Radio. If you can be quick, we can try to get you an answer.
Yes, sir. My question was, is there a significant difference in between the Protestant Bibles and the Catholic Bible? And if so, what
thank
is
you.
It?
Thank you, Roy.
Okay, we're going to want to send Roy a copy of The Bible as a Catholic Book, so let's get set up for that. The differences in most translations are minor, but most Protestant Bibles today are missing certain books that you will find in Catholic Bibles. These books are often called by Protestants the Apocrypha. In Catholic circles, they're called the Deuterocanonicals, and Catholics, like most Christians historically, have considered these books to be scripture. But in the Protestant community, Protestants generally don't consider them to be scripture. There's a lot of history here that I can't really go into right now, but the translations these days are pretty similar. There is the difference of these books that you won't find in most Protestant Bibles. You can read more about all this in my book, The Bible is a Catholic Book, and I hope it helps you out.
Hang on, Roy. We'll get your address, and we'll send you that book if you'd like it. And, boy, you really were quick with that question, Roy. Thanks very much. Jimmy Akin, we're not done with you this week. We'll see you again on Thursday for more Open Forum, right?
I'll see you then, yeah.
Well, thank you very much. I'm glad we will. Let me let you know again, we've still got the deal on the hotel rooms at the Catholic Answers annual conference coming up, and we'd love it if you'd join us. Just go to CatholicAnswersConference.com to reserve your spot and book your room. That does it for us. We'll see you tomorrow, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.